Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome back to the Prep to Pro NBA Draft Podcast. My name is Ben Pfeiffer, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host Max Carlin. Max, how's it going today?
I'm doing well, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, and we have our token host PD back on at this point. So PD, how's it going?
It's going well. Thank you guys for having me.
Of course. So today we're gonna talk about just disappointing freshmen from this year. There were a bunch of them. It was not an inspiring year of college basketball. I think the probably most logical place to start would be the two Duke like wing forward types who, I don't know, feature probably pretty prominently in a lot of draft Twitter lotteries. Wendell Moore less so in the mainstream, but Matthew Hurd, I think, was pretty widely like a top 20-ish guy. And both were top 30 or so RSCI guys. I mean, very, very different players, like pretty much like complete opposites. Whereas Wendell Moore is, I think, the youngest player in the class. Matthew Hurt, pretty old. Wendell Moore, a very physically overwhelming, wing forward player. Matthew Hurt, very skilled and intelligent, but, strikingly physically underdeveloped. So I guess before we go into, you know, what they were like at Duke. PD, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you thought of, let's go with Wendell Moore, I guess, pre-college.
There is no shortage of action going on with our partners over at betonline.ag. The sports world is slowly making its way back with the NBA announcing its return in late July. But right now, UFC, boxing, NASCAR, and international soccer have all resumed play, and BetOnline has the best odds / lines for their best upcoming games and matches. Need more? BetOnline has simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC happening live every day for our devout gamblers to check out. BetOnline also offers hundreds of live casino games, poker tournaments, and the best props in the business. Visit betonline.ag on your computer or mobile device and join now to receive your welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online wagering experts.
Pre-college, Wendell Moore was probably the upside bet. There are people who had him as like a top 10 pick with production at Duke and with fitting into a system that has historically done well to big wings. Using that youth and his pretty monstrous wingspan to really project forward. The movement skills were a pretty obvious concern, as was the creation ability. But I think going into the year, there were a lot of people extremely excited to get him in the into a big-time system and play a big-time role. With Hurt, there was never a question of if he was going to produce. It was just how much that production would mean for what he gives back on defense. And I think the year kind of played out to some degree for both of them. Moore's youth didn't translate in terms of exponential value, and Hurt's defense was a problem enough that Duke only played him half the time.
Yeah, I think there are interesting lessons to be taken from both of them. I think with Moore, there was a lot of irresponsible, maybe, projection going on with him, or unfair, where he, you know, he had things like pretty solid decision making, very, very impressive physically. Like, he is a strong, well-built player while being really, really young. And he was obviously like a total outlier free throw guy for a player that size. I forget exactly what the numbers are, but on a pretty good sample, I think like around 85%, which is really unusual for a a 6'7" player at that age. But there was a lot of taking that foundation and projecting him as a star sort of prospect, which was never the appeal to me. And granted, I was fooled by Wendell Moore and had him way too high. But the appeal to me was kind of that he has a real chance to be this complimentary wing who is pretty valuable on defense. And then, you know, I bought him at the very least as a spot up guy and a closeout attacker, and a guy who could, you know, finish through contact then after that and make solid decisions attacking closeouts. And there's a lot of value in that when you're just like a good wing who takes nothing away. But I think taking that to the extension of, you know, this guy has genuine star upside was probably where people went a bit too far.
Yeah, I think the free throw point is important because, I mean, Wendell Moore was still a very good free throw shooter at Duke despite low volume. I think he was on 80% on like 60 attempts, and AAU stats has him at 86% on 114 attempts in his last summer playing UIBL, which AAU stats is, I'm pretty sure, is missing games, so that number is incomplete, but still a pretty significant sample and a very, like Max said, like especially for that age and size, being that good of a free throw shooter is really rare. But in terms of like actual, you know, shooting on the floor, he didn't really show much. I mean, again, besides not really being able to create for his own shot with, you know, just a really poor handle, which was terrible in high school, probably a little bit better at Duke, but still not great, and no burst to really get to open spots. He was never that great as a pull-up shooter, and he didn't really shoot this year at Duke either. I mean, he took less than 20 threes on the whole, and that's really concerning for his overall shooting projection, as we talked about plenty on this podcast, the importance of things like volume and versatility as a shooter. And I don't believe he took a lot of long twos anyway.
No,
either.
He didn't. 27% of his shots were two-point jumpers, and he shot 31% of them on them.
Yeah.
And I think they were, even for long twos, they were pretty assisted, around 40% assisted. So these were not self-created long twos.
Only 13 makes not great for his shooting projection. And again, I mean, I'm not like, I don't have like the greatest feel on his passing. I didn't think it was great at Duke. Again, like a function of not being able to get to spots really at all and having no gravity on offense. Just concerns about what he does going forward, because I mean, his youth, as we talked about before we started recording, his youth was as an asset, but he's getting older. And if he doesn't put anything together as he ages, that youth becomes less and less important, and especially with the Duke's roster construction next season, bringing in so many talented freshmen, I think there's a real chance that he gets squeezed out of the rotation if he can't, you know, really make a step forward and provide consistent impact on at least one end of the floor. Because I mean, there were games and there were moments where he was, you know, he was able to physically overwhelm college opponents and, you know, get to the rim and draw fouls. Another one thing he did well, he did draw fouls well this year, I believe. And then defensively, you know, just being in the right spots. But and like PD said, the movement is definitely an issue. But yeah, I'm not so sure he's able to really stay in the rotation next year. And if that's the case, then it gets even murkier for his prospects as, you know, a future NBA guy.
Yeah, I think he did this year improve a little bit as a handler, because in high school it was really bad. Like, he couldn't dribble at all, and it wasn't like an Okoro level improvement where he was like, you know, actually fooling guys with his handle. But I think it was a little less bad. That said, I mean, he was still terrified to shoot and couldn't finish at all. But the point of Duke's you know, incoming roster next year, I think, is really important. We've talked about it a little bit in the past, I think maybe in one of the mailbags, that they've got a weird group next year. So they've got a bunch of forwards coming in to join Hurt and Moore, who are both returning. And of those guys, Jalen Johnson is pretty much a non-shooter. Jamin Brakefield is like a pretty good shooter. And then they've got Jeremy Roach as a guard, who's like pretty much a non-shooter. Stewart, who's really good as a shooter, and then a couple bigs also who are not big-time shooters. So I guess, PD, how do you feel about Moore going forward, especially in the context of this suboptimal roster that Duke has next year.
I think it's important to note that the handling can improve, but he's going to have even less opportunities next year. So he has to make more out of his handle with less of a chance. And with younger guys, they just need the chance to make mistakes, and there isn't really a certainty that that's going to happen. And the freshmen they're bringing in are much older freshmen. I think Brakefield is almost a full year older than him, if I have that correct.
Yeah, Brakefield is pretty solidly older than Wendell Moore.
Yeah,
he's very old for the class, and Moore, again, was the youngest player in the class.
And so we're in a situation where everyone that they've brought in has a singular skill, except for Wendell Moore, whose best skill might just be that he has a really high upside. So, you know, with how Duke has built its rotations, if you can't bring exactly what Kay wants, you fall off. And this is sort of going to be a make or break summer for him, his skill development, where if he doesn't get the thing that makes Kay play him, like, there's a really solid chance he could be back for a junior year.
Yeah. And I think that, oh,
no, Ben, go ahead.
Yeah. That leans well, at least leans better for a guy like Matthew Hurt, who again had similar struggles to Wendell Moore this season at Duke, you know, just really not being able to hang physically on both ends, you know, especially defense. But Matthew Hurt can shoot the hell out of the ball. He always has, and that's one skill he has, and one skill that will get him on the floor, especially on a Duke team next year, like we talked about, that has really no floor spacing. So Hurt was around like 60% EFG on catch and shoot jumpers this year. Was pretty good on pull-ups, I believe, in low volume. Is overall just an awesome versatile shooter at 6'9". So that's going to be a skill set that Duke especially really, really needs. And even if Hurt is taking away worse defense than they could have got out of somebody else, or just less creation or less rebounding or whatever, that shooting is really necessary. And even if, you know, he's not playing great, he's going to have to see the floor, which is going to allow him to, you know, have more reps and be able to improve and make mistakes, because his leash is going to be longer because he's going to shoot, and Duke just needs that shooting.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty disappointed to see both of them return, to be honest. Less so for Hurt, because like you said, I think he does have a clear way. Like, Duke, I think, is just straight up going to need his shooting next year. Whereas Wendell Moore really could see himself possibly fall out of the rotation with all the forward talent that they have. But nonetheless, like, Hurt is the one that I'm still definitely in on, as opposed to kind of like tentatively optimistic, which is the case for Moore. Because Hurt, like, there aren't a lot of guys in the world who are 6'9", very good shooters, pretty skilled ball handlers, very smart, pretty mobile. Like, even with a terrible frame and a truly, truly terrible frame, Hurt is fairly outlier in really, really valuable categories. Like you said, I mean, he's the shooting alone at that size is extraordinarily valuable. And the fact that he has diversity with it, like he can do the Klay Thompson no dip off the catch shots because he just flings it like from his shoulder. But he is an incredible shooter. And that alone is just highly valuable. But I'm curious, PD, what your like in-depth thoughts were on Hurt coming into the year.
I deeply disliked Kay's center rotation last year. I think that the thing that you needed to pair Hurt with was just somebody who covered the rim, and pairing him and Vernon Carey together seemed to be a failure from the start, because you didn't have anybody who would erase the mistakes that were invariably going to happen with Hurt and Moore. Just some quick stats for Hurt. He was 96th percentile on post-ups, 92nd percentile against half-court man, 92nd percentile on all jump shots, 91st on three-point jump shots, and 90th percentile on unguarded jumpers. He played 50.5% of Duke's minutes. It's mind-bending. It's mind-bending, and it's mind-bending because, like, any coach in America would have put a shot blocker. I mean, the one that's going to haunt Matthew Hurt's bank account for some time is that he didn't go to Kansas to play with Doak.
Yeah.
Because that would have been the easiest thing in the entire world. And
that would have been huge for Kansas too.
And that, yeah, and it would have fit perfectly with their roster. And I think Kansas, up until a very late point, thought that they had this in the bag. And with Hurt, he's going to play. There's still going to be weird lineups. And there's almost no way to build a normal looking lineup with the group that Duke has, because if you put like more passing next to Hurt, like with Coleman, then you have to play Johnson at the two, and then you can't get Roach and Stewart on the court at the same time. Like it's going to be an insane puzzle box. And one that I'm excited to watch in a somewhat perverse way. But it's going to be one of those things where, like, on a night-by-night basis, you're going to see a different team. And maybe even by a half-by-half basis. Because, like, looking at some of these splits from Duke last year, which had a not great but a little bit more clear roster situation, in my opinion, like, there's still times where I'm like, why is Matthew Hurt not playing in this particular game? It can't be that difficult to scheme around things. So, yeah, I think that he's guaranteed to play. I think that his effectiveness might be a little bit weird just based on some of these extremely strange fits that Kay has selected around him.
Do you guys think that there's that there are any like larger lessons to be learned from either of these guys? Because the one that like pops out to me with Hurt is definitely accounting for something like a lack of functional strength, where this year at Duke, he just got bullied so badly. And I mean, it was obviously always going to be a problem, but at lower levels, he was like, I think notably a lot larger than everyone else. And just being 6'9" and like legitimately very skilled as a shooter, as a handler and shot maker, is a really overwhelming when you're playing against that level of competition. But I think it was something that I had noted preseason, even, that's just like, yeah, I have some reservations about Hurt as a shot creator, because you know, you can no longer overwhelm with size when you're 6'9" and like, I don't know, 195 or whatever he is. But I mean, do you guys have like major takeaways from that? Or do you think that, you know, these guys are not necessarily isolated cases, but you're not making, you know, like large scale takeaways from these?
Yes. My biggest takeaway from both Hurt and Moore is that analysts overestimate the discomfort level that coaches are willing to deal with on the floor. That like the first time that Hurt gets blown by, it's like, maybe we'll take him out. And the second time that there's just an awful looking defensive possession, he's going to get yanked. And that we tend to think like, oh, he's a five star. Oh, there's such a clear offensive value. But like looking like a seventh grade game at times is just something that high major coaches are not willing to roll with, even if there is long term benefits for it.
Do you think that's more of a college thing, or do you think that applies as well to the NBA, for example?
I think that there's more trade-off in the NBA. Like, I think that because teams are a little more set, there are things that coaches just allow to happen. Like, D'Antoni just has things that he's going to let occur. And temperament, you know, mileage varies. But in college specifically, like, I just think that there's such a high level placed on competence and, like, this idea of maturity, that when things look a little bit wonky or, you know, like juvenile, coaches will just snap out of it and say no.
Because this kind of makes me like vividly picture how SEC teams started to cover Isaac Okoro as conference play progressed, where they just completely ignored him as a shooter and just used that defender to sort of gum up things off the ball. And it's definitely worrisome for a prospect like that, where I think we've discussed in pretty good depth that you need to handle him in a very specific way. And if coaches are made uncomfortable by that, that's pretty concerning, because Isaac Okoro is not a guy that you can just throw out there and expect things to function normally. So if that's a problem that you think persists across various levels, that would be very concerning to me for someone like Okoro, in addition to of course, like Hurt. But yeah, I think it's definitely a worthwhile point.
And it makes sense. Oh,
no, go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, at least at the college level, that these coaches would have, especially like the big blue blood kind of coaches, would have less investment in the development really of their specifically like their five-star guys who they expect to be one and done. And you know, like playing through Matthew Hurt's mistakes is definitely going to be beneficial for Hurt long term, but it doesn't really benefit Duke if they expect him to leave after 1 year. and don't expect to reap any of the benefits from that. So that makes sense. And I think, it just gives me more interest, especially relating this to, you know, the NBA, whether, you know, coaches are more or less likely to allow guys to play through mistakes. And that obviously is going to vary by team and, you know, vary by situation, but, you know, hoping to see more expansion within things like the G League to have like a more designated environment for players to get reps and rookies specifically to get reps and make mistakes. Cause like even the good rookies, like rookies aren't like good generally. I mean, and that's like a different thing from other sports. I think specifically the NFL, where like a lot of rookies come in and are like the best players on their teams, or some of them, and the NBA, that just doesn't really happen. So, you know, yeah, I mean, hopefully there's more of an avenue for these guys to, you know, make mistakes and develop. Cause like especially for guys like Okoro or guys like Hurt, who just aren't physically good enough to really hang. And if they don't have a chance to, you know, if their body's lagging behind, then that means their actual skill development will as well, if they're not able to, you know, make play actual basketball and make improvements in games.
Yeah, I would agree with that NFL idea. I would say that in any sport where there's an isolation event, like, you know, a pitcher swinging or a pitcher throwing the ball, batter can hit it, like those allow youth to make more impact because there isn't the expectation of well-rounded application. So I think the easiest comparison is like international soccer, where 17-year-olds can like do good in really small moments. But when you expect them to have these overarching organizational impacts, it's just not going to happen. The lesser their job, the better. And I think you're going to see a lot of that carry over as we look at the G League and we look at these younger players across the stratum.
Before we before we move on to the next disappointing freshman, I want to like add a segment that we hadn't planned for, but I'm gonna put you guys on the spot. After their disappointing freshman seasons, are you buying or selling Wendell Moore and Matthew Hurt? I guess we'll start with Ben. We'll give PD some extra time.
I'm probably gonna be neutral to buying on Hurt and selling on Moore, and I think a lot of that comes to just the, you know, like we talked about, the rotational flexibility that I believe these guys are going to have next year. Because with Hurt, I mean, even aside from the shooting, and we talked about how weird the roster constructions are going to be with just the talent he has, I think Hurt allows you with more malleability there. Because aside from just being able to shoot, I mean, assuming he gets more of a leash and is allowed like to do more things with the ball. Because, I mean, at Duke this year as freshman, he wasn't really given the space to create or play with the ball at all, but he can really like make decisions and he can pass better than he's shown this year at Duke, and especially in transition as like a grab and go guy. He showed that a lot in FIBA and in UAA too, where he's just, besides being bigger than guys, he's really smart and pretty coordinated for a guy his size. So I just think that works better, you know, trying to, you know, help, you know, he has the passing and the shooting potentially and the decision making acumen to potentially cover for weaknesses of some of the freshmen and maximize them. Or, I mean, we keep talking about more of just skepticism that he's really going to get in rotation. And I wanted to make one more point before we moved on to, aside from this, you know, another takeaway from this, and that relates to more for me. And that's really to buy less into like isolated indicators and look more at like the full package. Because, I mean, when you look at, I mean, more, I mean, if you list off indicators, super young, high free throws on high volume, and crazy wingspan. I mean, those three things are like invariably positive for any prospects. And just putting those together, I mean, that was the thing that I overvalued, was, you know, he has all these indicators. He's going to put it together without really thinking more critically about what the whole package looks like and what it's going to look like when it translates. And when you look at the whole, you know, the whole of Wendell Moore as a prospect, you see a lot of issues. You know, it doesn't really matter if he can, you know, if he's a great free throw shooter, if he can't get to spots to hit shots, you know, it doesn't matter if he has a great wingspan, if he can't get to the rim and finish. So I think just looking more, I don't know if holistically is the word, but it's, again, I mean, just being more complete in analysis and not taking these indicators at really as face value and looking deeper into a player. But yeah, I mean, back to, you know, I guess like buying Hurt, selling more is what I'd go with.
PD?
I would buy more or buy Hurt, just because he does the thing that everybody swore up and down that he would do. There's never been a doubt from, like, you know, from age 15 on that Matthew Hurt would shoot the hell out of the ball with a high release point. And as he gets further along up the basketball ladder, there's going to be more fives who can cover up his weaknesses and more need for spacing. I would have to sell my very large amount of stock in Moore unless he can transfer to like Houston or something. Get him to Kelvin ASAP. Then I think that your point about disparate tools is really valuable, because it doesn't matter how many indicators there are. If there's not a larger plan for them to get reps, it doesn't work. Like, I think that Moore is indicative of that point because he did not get the opportunity to really overexpose himself to the game. And while practice reps are valuable, like, he needs to make mistakes to see what he can do and really explore the studio space. And as we're going to get to when we talk about some of the Kentucky guys, like, if you are a younger player who does not have a extremely specific skill, getting to a place where they will let you rock out is so important.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. I'm buying Hurt pretty big time for next year, just because I think they're going to need him. Like, they're going to need that shooting with the roster that they have. And just generally, I think we've kind of beaten this to death, that what Hurt has is a really valuable skill set, even if he is a pretty flawed player. Moore, I'm selling in the short term. Like, I kind of think that he'll stay at school, but maybe transfer after next year, in which case maybe long term I'm still kind of tentatively in, just because he has a really good body, and, you know, there just aren't that many guys at that size with you know, those physical tools. And then, you know, there's the touch indicators are still there to some extent, but yeah, for next year, I'm certainly not buying him. So I would think probably he'll be maybe a disappointing sophomore in addition to a disappointing freshman. Should we move on now to Trey Mann, the Florida point guard?
Sure.
So, Trey Mann was a guy who had fans in draft Twitter and had skeptics. I was among the fans, not sure about you guys, but the whole appeal with Trey Mann, small guard, not a great decision maker, but a ridiculous pull-up shooter with crazy range and really, really good change of direction. So he could really set up ball screens. He could, with that threat of the pull-up, leverage that to then, you know, get into the defense, just because he could sharply change direction and absolutely lose people. But I mean, just a small guard who's not a very good decision maker, not like an overwhelming athlete aside from the change of direction stuff, that doesn't leave you with a lot of margin for error. And there are just so many guys at lower levels who are exactly like that. And Trey Mann really, really struggled at Florida. He didn't shoot particularly well. The decision making was very bad. He just, on the whole, wasn't very good. So PD, were you a Trey Mann believer coming into the year, or a skeptic?
I think I was a lot more skeptical than the people on draft Twitter. The Florida context really scared me, because when I saw Trey in high school, it was very much like a Norman, Oklahoma Trey Young situation, where like he got all the shots, he got to do what he wanted to. And the adjustment from that to like sometimes playing off ball or having 10 start possessions where you don't touch it, like, that's a really different way of processing the game. And if the jumper is not going, then it gets even harder. And I think that we saw a lot of that. Like, he'd struggled to generate offense when he didn't have the ball in his hands. He's undersized, the finishing's not great, and he struggled to get to the free throw line. So I think that if, you know, Nembhard wasn't there, or the offense was run a little bit differently, or, you know, different priorities were put in place, I would have bought the context more. But it just seemed to me like a perfect storm of, like, if he starts to shoot at a normal rate, because, again, in high school, like, he had games where he got ludicrously hot. If that normalizes to, you know, a level that might be worse, or, you know, if the lifting doesn't really take to him, then he could be in trouble. And that's sort of what we saw play out this year. And then you get the defense issues added on top of that.
Yeah, I think I mean, I was not as big a fan as Max, but I was still on the optimistic side when it came to Trey Mann. And what I take away from his performance at Florida is just like how I underrated how much the physicality and the burst would really be an issue. I mean, because when you watch him play at Florida, he just struggled so much to get to the rim and to really create as much space as he should be able to with that elite handle and that really elite, you know, shiftiness and change of direction. I mean, this season at Florida, only 17% of his shots came at the rim, and he shot 48% on those. And it was just so evident with, you know, that he had not nearly enough burst to get into the defense consistently, not strong enough to draw fouls, not explosive enough to jump and finish. And I just think, again, like similarly to Hurt, though different, I should have been more wary of that lack of physicality on both ends. Because, I mean, there were still good moments with Trey Mann. There were certain games, I think like the last Georgia game, off the top of my head, he had like quite a few good, you know, change of direction moments, creating for threes. And I think generally he was like I didn't hate the activity when it came to his defense off the ball, but he was just too small and not athletic enough to really make a difference. So yeah, I'm just skeptical because he's going to have to be a really good shooter to make it work. Because he just has nothing inside the arc in terms of getting to the rim. And I mean, if you were a better passer, I might be more in. But again, that's a more difficult part of this game to parse, especially, you know, he's certainly not an off-ball passer, which, you know, he wasn't able to do at Florida. And with Nembhard gone this year, he could potentially, you know, I'm very interested to see him play again this year with him definitely getting more reps on the ball, you know, with Nembhard transferred. See if he really can, you know, see what the passing looks like more on ball, see if he can keep some sustained, you know, shooting success over a long period of time, because he really is going to have to be a great shooter if he's going to be an NBA prospect at this point. So
I think two big mistakes that I made with Mann were one, just because I liked him, thinking that overestimating the chances of him improving on his weaknesses, which is definitely, I think, something that we're all guilty of with prospects that we like, whether it's, you know, stylistically or just, you know, I mean, it can be guys who are very good and enjoyable to watch, but you're too generous with the evaluation there. And then the other thing was that I just didn't hold him to the same standard that I do for small guards normally. I think we have a well-established tradition on this podcast of being fairly skeptical of tiny scoring guards. And that's what Trey Mann is. And yet I still bought in. I was influenced by just having the small sample Garland thing the year before, because I do think there are some similarities there in terms of a guard who's really, his game is built around pull-up shooting and kind of change of direction stuff. But yeah, I just think that it was getting caught up too much in that, which kind of brings me to the question of whether or not you guys think Trey Mann still has a chance to break out. Because like Ben said, Nembhard is transferring now. Trey Mann, like, conceivably should have a chance to be the guy there. So I'm curious what you guys think. My inclination is kind of just that I think he could be a pretty good college scoring guard. I'm skeptical of him as a serious NBA guy, but like Ben said, the change of direction flashes were still there. The pull-up flashes were still there. I mean, in the half court, he was actually 74th percentile on off the dribble jumpers. Like, he shot pretty well. It just, you know, it's not the nuclear level that he'd have to be at to be a real prospect at that size and with those decision-making flaws. Like, one of the things that I brought up with him preseason was the idea of kind of the inverse of what we talked about with Kyra Lewis with the touch skill between off the dribble passing and off the dribble shooting. I thought Trey Mann, maybe because he was such a brilliant off the dribble shooter, that maybe there were some off the dribble passing functionality things there, not in terms of decisions, but just in execution of passes. And I remember watching one of the preseason games, and he was just like very casually and smoothly throwing these like live dribble passes, and while they weren't, you know, anything impressive from a decision standpoint, it's just like, okay, this is to a point where if he has significant scoring gravity and there are easy decisions to be made, then he can act on them. But I, you know, that's only so that's only relevant if you're such a good scoring gravity guy anyway, and he probably isn't anywhere but the 3-point line, even best case scenario. So are you guys, what are you guys thinking going forward with Trey Mann?
I'm probably still selling at this point. I don't have a ton of confidence after seeing, looking at the necessary improvement areas. I think he just has to be such a better, so much better of a shooter than he already is. And he's already a pretty good shooter, like Max said. I mean, he was good this year in low volume. And I just don't think there's much room for improvement when it comes to that frame, which is really my big issue. And I don't know. I mean, good college scoring guard, I think, is definitely in the cards for Trey Mann. And I think he's probably at his peak, probably a 3-4 year guy, in my opinion, and probably going to end up being a pretty solid college player. But again, I just am skeptical. Like you said, small scoring guard without any real plus passing or physicality. So yeah, and especially just not trusting Mike White, not trusting Florida as an infrastructure and as an ecosystem for good development. I'm unfortunately saying my Trey Mann stock is on the market. So
I'm probably going to buy Trey White stock. I think that they didn't bring in a single guard for next year. They're all wings and forwards. I think that this year's shooting was probably like a 50th percentile outcome for him in terms of the level that I probably think of him as a shooter. So he's going to get more reps. The thing that I would like to most be most interested in is the finishing. And it doesn't even have to be by percentage. It just has to be by free throw. He did not get to the line enough. And it's difficult to be a player who lives and dies off the dribble jumpers if you can't credibly threaten to get yourself into the rhythm at the free throw line. So he's going to have an opportunity next year to put up some pretty heavy numbers, because I don't really feel great about the rest of the creation burden. You have shooters with Rushdev and Niles Lane. I think that there's an opportunity for him to rise into the second round for just having a nuts creation season. And for guys who can get that hot, I think he's good for a couple games where you look back and say, oh, I see the freshman version that I really, or the high school version that I really bought into, not the freshman version that really scared me.
There is no shortage of action going on with our partners over at betonline.ag. The sports world is slowly making its way back, with the NBA announcing its return in late July. But right now, UFC, boxing, NASCAR, and international soccer have all resumed play, and BetOnline has the best odds/lines for their best upcoming games and matches. Need more? BetOnline has simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC happening live every day for our devout gamblers to check out. BetOnline also offers hundreds of live casino games, poker tournaments, and the best props in the business. Visit betonline.ag on your computer or mobile device and join now to receive your welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online wagering experts.
Oh no!
Those are the screams I used to make when I would cut myself shaving before I knew about Manscaped. Thank you, Manscaped, for turning my loud shrieks into multiple peaks. Men, start taking notes, because Manscaped accidents are finally a thing of the past. The Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0 has been beautifully designed to reduce those painful nicks and tugs. This is their third generation trimmer, featuring advanced skin-safe technology so you keep your bad boys nice and smooth. When I tell you this is premium, I mean premium. The battery will last up to 90 minutes so you can take a longer shave. The water-resistant technology allows you to shave in the shower too. One of the coolest features is the LED light, which illuminates grooming areas for closer and more precise trimming. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code armchair at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com, and use code armchair. Your balls will thank you.
So I know you guys weren't huge fans, but another guy who I liked coming into the year was Trey Mann's AU teammate on E1T1, CJ Walker, who went to Oregon last year. Didn't play much, wasn't very good, and transferred to, what was it, UCF?
Yeah.
So the appeal of Walker to me was that with E1T1, he kind of like played like a big and was a pretty good interior defender. He was at 2.4 blocks a game on AAU stats. They have him at a 9% block rate, and he was really good at that. And then meanwhile, with his high school team, And these games were pretty hard to find, and they were not numerous, and they were not good quality. They were like the handheld parent on the sideline situation. But with his high school team, he did a lot more like perimeter creation, and he had some flashes as a handler and as a passer. And I bought into the combination of those two things in this guy who's like 6'7" and a pretty good athlete, who also just had like a very, very good motor. The reason that I think that I fell for CJ Walker when I shouldn't have was that I bought into perimeter flashes with him. And I think that's an especially bad thing to do because I'm so aware of how perimeter flashes get big men overrated at that level. So like with Wiseman, that was obviously a big problem that, you know, every once in a while he would handle in the open court and it still wouldn't look very good, but he would do it and he would take really, really bad turnarounds. And that got him, you know, ranked as number one, in addition to being, you know, a 7'1" gargantuan human being. But yeah, I think falling for perimeter flashes with Walker while being so cognizant of that being a problem with big men in ranking at that age was not good. And especially with a guy who's 6'7", like you don't have the margin for error that Wiseman does. Like you actually need to be a perimeter player. You can't just be a 6'7" big man and be in like a real NBA prospect, barring like super outlier Draymond Green types. But yeah, I think that buying into perimeter flashes for a guy whose game had to be centered on the perimeter was really bad process. And like there were still, I think, defensive flashes from Walker this year, but I'm certainly not buying him as an NBA prospect anymore. I guess I'm mildly curious to see what he turns into at UCF. But yeah, that was not a good miss by me.
Yeah, I think, one, I'm maybe fortunate I didn't end up catching his like high school games because I was never aware of those flashes. I think, you know, it's something that our friend Mike Grivenoff talks a lot about. And it's like how much value to place in these like not prep level high school games. Because I mean, if a legitimate prospect doesn't look very, very good against lower level high school competition, like that's a big issue because it's just so low level. Obviously when you're talking about schools like Montverde and IMG and Patrick School,
just be noted with Walker that he was a good AAU player. Like is not a situation where he just dominated a lower level of like Oscar Tshiebwe, like dominated, I think, pretty low level of high school basketball and then played UA, I think. So he wasn't even playing UIBL and he was very, very good in that. But
yeah, he was good.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that like Walker played UIBL and was good in that too.
Yeah, I'm just
as more of like a big man type.
Yeah, I'm just using to make the point that again, skeptical of guys who are like outlierly dominant or even like just not dominant, like especially guys who are not super dominant and are considered to be prospects, especially if they're like really, really toolsy or athletic at these lower levels. That's like a massive, massive red flag for me. And, you know, I think that's an important teaching point. But yeah, I mean, I just wasn't really see it with Walker. Again, in Oregon, I mean, there were some interesting flashes of like rim protection because he is a really good athlete and he plays really hard. Well, so that'll get him on the floor in college, probably all 4 years. I mean, I see him being a contributor at this level, but again, just doesn't really do anything on offense. Like there's like the odd, like random, like movement shooting three flash or like close out attacking flash. But again, like it's very clear he can't dribble. He doesn't really have any feel at the college level. Yeah, I mean, again, like at UCF, I get mildly curious to see. Because like, I mean, he's definitely more likely to crack the rotation at UCF than at Oregon. So
yeah. Cause Oregon has already a lot of 6'7" big men who can't shoot.
Yeah. And they have like actual big men.
The perimeter flashes thing is big though. Like I needed to be more consistent on that. I mean, not even more consistent, needed to be like harder on that with a wing type guy or like a wing forward type guy, because you know, that's your whole offensive game as opposed to a big man where that's just added value.
Yeah. With this like intermediate size, hyper athlete, like Walker is, with, you know, feel issues, it's really important that they go to a developmental situation where the athleticism can be leveraged and the feel can be gradually worked on. And the Oregon situation just wasn't that. It's difficult for anyone to develop feel in low minutes or in low exposure, especially when they're not immediately playing downhill. And I just felt like Walker was put in no situation to really succeed if he didn't, you know, become a great shooter overnight or over the summer. And again, if you are a prospect who is requires specific situations to succeed, you need to go to a place where those situations are met. And that's why UCF is encouraging. I've really liked what, like, the spacing that they've had, and I've really liked the X's and O's. So he seems like somebody who I would probably bet on doing insane things at UCF on a nightly basis, which to me is going to be more essential for his development.
Should we move on to a very, very different player now in Isaiah Mobley, the USC big man, older brother of, he's not the number one recruit in the high school class of 2020, but among the top recruits, Evan Mobley, they'll be playing together next year at USC. So I don't know what you guys thought of Mobley coming into the year. I liked him, but PD, you want to give your pre-college Mobley take?
I was really high on Evan Mobley, or I was really high on Isaiah. Sorry.
Yeah.
There was a lot of Jontay Porter, and my I was looking through the Jontay Porter colored glasses, just seeing somebody who was super high feel with Compton Magic when they would roll out the two Mobleys plus Onyeka. There'd be a lot of ball handling for him, and I thought the ball handling plus shooting flashes were going to be enough to force him into these like high post jumpers a lot and force him into a modern usage, even if USC didn't tilt that way. And didn't really get any of that this year at USC.
Yeah. I was a big Isaiah Mobley guy as well. Like he was really, really smart. And I mean, both of the Mobleys are such good passers, such good ball handlers. Like Isaiah Mobley, you're talking about like a 6'11 big man who was running pick and roll and stuff and like legitimately initiating offense, which was, I mean, not just cool, but a demonstration of really high skill level and feel. But yeah, he's not a very good athlete and doesn't really have any way to score, not nearly a good enough shooter. And it was not a good freshman year at USC.
Yeah, I was a little lower on Mobley coming in. I still liked him a lot, especially relative to consensus, but I was a little more worried about the frame and about the shot translating. And I think that definitely came to fruition at USC. One, I mean, USC just being a far from ideal context, you know, playing with poor spacing, playing next to other bigs who, you know, often weren't very good passers or decision makers like Mobley. And then just not being able to handle, you know, the physical demands of, you know, playing big at the college level. I mean, I recently just remember, you know, like it was like that Colorado at USC game where Tyler Bay just annihilated him on both ends with and just being more athletic and more physical. And obviously Bay is like an incredible defender and a pretty good athlete, but that happened a lot at USC when he played. And there just wasn't consistent minutes. And then, I mean, offensively, like the pass, like he just wasn't given a leash to handle and to make decisions in the pass. And he wasn't, and the scoring was pretty miserable. I mean, we were talking about this before, his true shooting against top 50 and his true shooting against at all competitions were miserable. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but somebody here might. Those were really bad. I'm at least excited to get at least one more full season of Evan and Isaiah playing together next season when Isaiah goes to USC, because those two have some really, really fun chemistry when they're on the floor together. So, like, that'll be fun.
I have the true shooting in front of me.
I think
it is 50.9 for all and 36.5 against top 50.
Not ideal. I'm excited for the reunion because Isaiah during his senior year and Evan during his junior year at Rancho Christian was like the best show in high school basketball. but yeah, I think one of the things to point out with Isaiah for sure is age, that he was already old, but then once USC published like birth dates for their roster, it turned out that he was a year older, I think, than everyone thought. So he'll be 21 in September as a sophomore, which is super, super old. And just, I mean, he was able to overcome physical deficiencies at lower levels and profited off of certain physical advantages, yeah. Like namely, you know, it's just size and length. Yeah, I mean, and he uses his length well, or at least did at lower levels. But yeah, just it kind of ties into me with like the whole Grant Williams and Xavier Tillman thing, that you do need some way to score. And I think that's abundantly clear when you look at, like, I remember talking about this last year in reference to like Thybul, I think it was, where like guys who are not scorers in the NBA still are pretty accomplished in larger roles at lower levels. So even if you look at someone like Draymond Green, like Draymond was a 16 point a game guy on 54 true shooting as a senior at Michigan State. Like, that's not a dominant scorer by any means, but that is a guy who has some sort of some baseline level of skills and athleticism and like finishing ability that he can do stuff on offense. Whereas when you're Isaiah Mobley, who's like, you know, 6'11 and can't really jump and is not nearly a good enough shooter, like, you don't really have any way to score. And even if you're not going to be an offensive hub, like, you do need to be able to do something on the offensive end. And I think that, so when you're starting at a level as low as high school or AAU, like, you need to be quite a good offensive player. And then in college, you need to, at the very least, be pretty solid. And Mobley is not that right now.
Yeah. For me, the example that I go back to for you got to score is that Pat Bev averaged a 40 ball in high school.
And like, but that's really true.
Yeah, like
it's super true.
It's one of those things that's like, well, NBA players are good. It's like, but you don't realize quite how good they are at lower levels until you follow, you know, them historically. So mm-hmm. A conversation that I've had more and more is when I'm going through tape, there's just a voice in the back of my head that says, show me the easy buckets that you can get in the half court. And just like the things that will translate most often are just like, can you get point blank looks? Can you get open shots? And with Mobley, he had 11 dunk attempts this year. And that's like really, really, really
dunk attempts, not even dunks,
just attempts. I think that like when you go through, he takes a lot of stuff that like is unnecessarily difficult because of his frame. Like his feel is super high. The main lesson that I take away, other than show me the easy looks, is that not everybody will use players in optimal context, and you have to price that into how you evaluate them. Like, I would have used Evan Mobley as a ball handler this year, and run a whole bunch of like Onyeka. Isaiah Mobley, do that all the time. I would run a bunch of Mobley Onyeka pick and roll because like they're both sick, they're both giant people. Like, fuck you, this is what we're gonna do. And that's not what happened. USC played three bigs all the time, and when evaluating players, it's important to price in that like Andy Enfield might disagree with everything you believe in and can tank players' usage because of it.
Yeah, but I think
it's. I was gonna say, go ahead, Ben.
I think the scoring point is really important. And I think like, I think of, you know, something that like Ben Rubin Stepien talked about a lot in the past, something that I try to, you know, I've kind of adapted. It's just like, if you're like a fifth offensive player level offensive player, you better be really good on defense, like have something to make up for it to really make it. I mean, the guy I think of like who I loved a lot last year was like who fit this bill was like Daquan Jeffries, who just couldn't really do anything on offense besides being like high feel. And like maybe shoot spot ups, and obviously he's like a very different player to Mobley being an awesome defender. But like Mobley again, like really high feel, obviously can potentially dribble if he's given the right situations. But I mean, if he's not put in positions to succeed, that's one. And if he doesn't have, you know, the frame to, you know, not get pushed off of his spots every time he tries to dribble, or you know, the frame or the burst to, you know, get any kind of open shots, you know, he's a guy that needs a lot of scheming to add the optimum value, and he's a guy who's likely never going to get the level of scheming he needs to really make the most out of his awesome feel and his awesome passing as, you know, a 6'11 big man. Because I mean, again, like PD said, I mean, if USC is going to play him at like the three and just like stick him in the corner or on the block, which was often the case playing next to Onyeka and like Nick Rakosevich, it was a really, really bad situation for Mobley. And it's not going to get any better next year. I mean, it's going to get marginally better because he's going to have his brother to play with. But in terms of roster construction and lineup fit, I don't see him getting much better. So, yeah, I mean, again, this is important to consider not only context, but, you know, how these how their skills fit in conjunction, and how these other skills unlock, you know, the passing and the dribbling that he shows, or how they don't unlock it.
The scoring point is like doubly true when your appeal is like Mobley, as just like this ultra high fuel guy who can kind of like create for others in a way that's abnormal for a guy his size, because it's not like he was, you know, a Draymond level defensive player. Like he did interesting things on defense, but a lot of the appeal with him was that he's the super high fuel offensive guy. Yeah. So I think it's just even more true that you need to be able to score somehow.
Yeah. And I think just, I mean, as we've kind of seen, I think like an overarching theme with a lot of the guys we talked about and some of them and guys we're going to keep talking about, is just like that frame is so important. Like Hurt, Trey Mann, now Mobley, is just like having functional strength is so incredibly valuable, even at the college level. And like, especially like understanding how that functional strength allows a player to use and inhibits a player from making the most out of his other skills. It's like a thing that it's so important to consider.
Should we move on now to the Kentucky wing forwards, Khalil Whitney and Keon Brooks?
Sure. So Khalil Whitney, both these guys were pretty highly ranked in RSCI. Whitney, I think, higher than Brooks last year. And, you know, Whitney kind of broke out on the EYBL circuit last year as, you know, this impressive athletic score. But the issue with him has always been just atrociously low feel. I think AAU stats has him at about a 0.45 assist to turnover ratio. And I think that might even be generous. I mean, the passing and the general court awareness was so bad. I mean, I mean he couldn't run a pick and roll and handle a trap without throwing the ball away. Didn't make any sort of advanced passes. And while he was a good athlete, certainly, and, you know, could shoot, his shot was unbroken. It was just always going to be harder for him to find a place. And at Kentucky, this was, you know, even more true than I think most of us thought. I mean, I was pretty low on Whitney coming in. I had him in the late 50s, but even he disappointed relative to my low expectations. I mean, he couldn't do anything offensively, just was never able to find a stride, was never able to, you know, that crippling feel was evident anytime he touched the ball. Defensively, I didn't think he was that horrible because, again, like, he's pretty big and he's athletic. And he can move fairly well, but again, like, he's not a four, and he's just like lacks so much feel on that end to make it work. And again, I mean, he was just so poor at Kentucky that he ended up, you know, not even finishing the season with the team. So yeah, Whitney was really, really rough at this year at Kentucky, and pretty much disappointed everyone's expectations. So why don't we get PD's take on Whitney, you know, pre-college?
I got to see Whitney in UIBL and in his high school setting, and the volume is something that jumps out for me in both of those. Like, if you look through the AAU stats, he's consistently taking, you know, 15, 16, 17, 20, 22 shots in these circumstances. And I thought that as a scorer, like, he really did start to develop as a senior year in high school, but it was mostly flashes. And the 40% EYBL number that's on AAU stats for 3-point shooting, for his 2-motion shot kind of scared me. Obviously, you don't want to take people when they're hot, and it felt like a lot of Whitney's shooting was unsustainable, especially because of how much it was off the dribble. And in high school, that wasn't just as much of that. Effort-based guys are always difficult to grade out when they're in smaller roles because there's just no guarantee that they get to get the same shots and that there's no guarantee that they'll give the same effort. That was a thing that you heard a little bit out of Kentucky, was that, like, you know, Whitney had his mind elsewhere at times. And I don't know. I think he was overranked a little bit, but he also went to a place, Kentucky, very similar to Duke, where if you don't have a skill that you can hang your hat on and produce in the moments that you're given, Wendy and Gabriel talked about this pretty publicly with Jaden McDaniels, that, like, if you can't do a thing the moment you step on the court, you kind of got to go back to the lab and figure it out, because Kentucky is a place for production.
Yeah, I think that it's worth pointing out with Whitney that he was highly regarded. Like, he was, I think, in the mainstream, like, ESPN Athletic was firmly lottery, possibly even top 10 for both of them. But he was a very highly regarded player. And that, I do not think, aligned with what he did in high school. Because, I mean, he was not good.
Yeah, he was 11th in RSCI.
Yeah, there were, I mean, the decision-making, frankly, was just catastrophic with him. Not to mention that, like, the creation was totally fraudulent because, like, he couldn't dribble. Like, he would, anytime he tried to, like, create for himself, would, like, dribble off his own feet and, like, throw the ball to the other team. Like, he was pretty horrendous. And I bought in a little bit based on just, at a certain point, a guy with a non-broken shot and very plus athleticism at 6'7", I thought was worth something. But that was sort of in the late, like, fringe first area, not in the lottery. But my kind of takeaway from that is that this is the flip side of the thing that I've said with Pat Williams about if you're, you know, wing, big wing sized and just not bad while being very young, that's super valuable. Like, that's something worth betting on. But if you're actively bad, which I think was the case with Whitney, then it, like, that rule is out the door. Like, you can't be actively destructive with, you know, tendencies and skills, I guess, or lack of skills that are actively harmful to a team, like where you have built up these bad habits and bad tendencies. Like, that, I think, is not an appealing prospect. Whereas with Williams, simply, like, not being bad while being that size and age is worthwhile. But yeah, I mean, it's I think Whitney's a classic example of don't buy tools that have little, basketball impact. Buy functional basketball traits. Don't buy leaping ability or a good body if the actual basketball traits are not good.
I don't have a historical recruiting table active. I remember Whitney being a pretty late riser in the process. So I think that he kind of went from, let's see if I have it here. I think he went from, like, a guy in the 50s and 60s into the, yeah, he wasn't ranked in March of 2018. Then he was 80s, 32, 20. And then by signing day, he was top 10. So this is somebody who had, like, always had the tools, and it started to click together at a high school level much later. And there's kind of two pathways I've experienced from that. Either those, like, that continues as a, like, it clicks for them in college, the tools that they have in high school, like, firmly the reads that they're making are the same, or they're just a little bit slower to process the game. And that feel will sort of replicate itself in college, where late bloomers will have a second late blooming process as they adjust those reads that may have worked in high school as a senior to not working again as a freshman. So that's always something that you should keep an eye on, is the historical recruiter ranking. Not that RSCI is perfect. Again, Desmond Bain was not ranked. Devin Vassell was a 2-star. Like, it's not to say that it's perfect, but the development arc and recruitment arcs are important for these prospects, especially these prospects in the 6'8 to 6'8, 6'6 to 6'8 range, because when it clicks, it can really, really click.
Yeah. Should we talk now a little bit about Keon Brooks, his Kentucky teammate? A different player, but flawed similarly in many ways. PD, you want to give your pre-college Keon Brooks take?
Yeah. I thought Brooks was a long-term guy. Lalu tends to turn out fundamentally solid wings who may take a little more time to get used to a system like Kentucky's. And I didn't really understand the one and done philosophy for him. He just seemed for me more of a guy who was a 2 or 3 year player who didn't have something that would immediately put him on the floor. Where were you guys at with him?
Yeah. I mean, I pretty much came away for a similar conclusion. I think on my earliest board, I ended up with him in, like, the 70s. Cause I mean, yeah, like Brooks is at his core, just like an energy guy. An energy kind of rebounding kind of wing with, like, a fine shot. I mean, again, like, the shot was nothing special, but it was good. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I remember them being fine enough. Like, again, nothing really worth writing home about. And yeah, I just no bankable skill on offense, not really able to dribble or self-create or pass or finish at a high level. Just someone who was going to come in and, like, give you energy and motor off the bench, play solid positional defense. And that's kind of what he did for Kentucky this year in a fairly small sample. But yeah, I mean, definitely in agreement there that he's not someone who I ever thought was going to be a one-and-done type. Kind of met my expectations, I would say, or was fairly close to them at Kentucky, if disappointed a little bit.
Yeah, I had Brooks in the 70s or something as well on my initial board. He was kind of like Whitney to me, not as catastrophic of a decision maker, but still pretty bad, but less from an athletic tools standpoint. And I don't remember how I felt about his shot in comparison to Whitney, but I was not particularly high on Brooks's shot even. Honestly, he probably exceeded my expectations at Kentucky because he carved out a real role. And I kind of thought it would be the other way around, that Brooks was going to be the one that would entirely flame out and Whitney would kind of carve out a minor role. So I was mildly surprised, but I mean, long-term, I'm still completely out on both of these guys. I would imagine you guys feel similarly, but does anyone even want to make the case for being in on either of these guys long-term?
I mean, Whitney is like entering the draft at this point, probably, right?
I don't know what's going to happen with him. Yeah, because he left Kentucky midway through the year, right? And it seemed like he was going to transfer. And then
overseas pro league.
He just declared for the draft.
Yeah. I mean, maybe like you chuck him in the G League as like a wing with tools and like, you know, send him to Toronto and like pray that they can squeeze
Ben wants to send all of the like bad but kind of athletic guys to Toronto, and they're
that's what happens anyway.
Well, no, I think they generally shoot for guys who are like athletic.
Yeah, I guess, but you know,
there's really a historical way forward. Like there's with like the decision making that I had with Whitney is like if you drop out, you need to have a plan immediately. Like no matter what, you have to do it boldly. And you just didn't hear from him for like a month, you know. Yeah. Then videos pop up of him working out.
Much about Whitney at this point. I mean, the last we heard from him was like in April-ish when the original deadline for the draft was hitting, and then the news came out that he was going to enter his name in the draft, and we have heard nothing.
From
Whitney, I believe.
Imagine a world where both of you two are advising Khalil Whitney. Like, what is it that you would tell him to get back onto radars? Because like I've struggled with this for 2 months. It's like I don't exactly know what you're supposed to do in his situation.
So I think that currently, I think ESPN actually still has him ranked in like the 80s. Maybe that's changed, but I think last I checked, they still had him ranked. So if you can ride RSCI to like getting onto a G, so they have him ranked 74th. If you can ride that RSCI into a spot on a G League team, I would go for it. Like just get in the building with a G League team and try to get an NBA team invested in you. Like at the end of the day, he is 6'7" with I think non-broken shot is a fair way to put it, and like good run jump athleticism. That is still a rare commodity, even if you are as limited as a basketball player as he is. So I would try to use that RSCI to latch on in the G League, and just hope that, you know, someone can mold from there. But I don't know. He's in a tough position. This situation played out terribly.
I mean, it depends on what the feedback is really then. I mean, if he could actually get onto a G League team, like Max said, ride that RSCI, I'm all for it. You know, get the money you can and, you know, just hope you can take that somewhere. I'm probably more realistic with him. With him, for me, would be to like transfer to, you know, lower caliber school, try to find a place where he can carve out a more consistent role, be afforded the luxury to play and make mistakes and play through mistakes, and hopefully try to develop some more basketball skill at some maybe mid or low major, is that's probably what he's tended for. I don't really think there's any high major rotation that has much use for Whitney at this point.
I just assumed he wasn't eligible.
He has to sit out probably this year.
It's difficult because like when you transfer out of a high major school, you already have a little bit working against you, and that like the people who are the most powerful in the league's ear, you know, kind of cast you to the side. I know that's not exactly how the situation at Kentucky played out, but like bombing out of Kentucky isn't really a great place to start for anybody. And yeah, like people like Brian Bowen didn't exactly make a name for themselves overseas. Like he's a better prospect than Bowen is. But
yeah, and Bowen still found his way, I mean, into the Pacers organization and landed a two-way. So
yeah, I mean, the G League is probably the best bet for him. I would also probably try to get, like, if you can get him into like Spanish B, that would also probably be interesting because they're probably going to use him as a straight four. You know, for guys like him, he hasn't had as much experience in his NBA role, you know, or what his NBA role projects to be. So getting there as soon as possible is an interesting one. I feel for Khalil Whitney just because, like, you know, we've all been in situations where you get things don't go according to plan, and maybe one of the more interesting long-term, like, how does this play out situations of this draft.
Yeah, I think that going to Spanish B is a lot to ask of a 19-year-old who is just a top 11 or a CI guy. I would think the move for him has to be try to latch on in the G League somewhere. But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty brutal situation for him. Got a feel for him. Should we talk now about someone who, like, slightly disappointed, but I think is still a pretty solid prospect in Oscar Tshiebwe?
Following the senseless murders of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and countless other Black community members at the hands of police officers, we want to ensure that we do what we can to make a tangible impact on those communities as we grow. Armchair Media will be issuing 4 $500 scholarships per semester to aspiring Black creatives. If you've ever been dismissed as having an unrealistic career path, if you ever butted heads with parents or teachers because they don't recognize exactly what you want to do with your life, if you have feared to express yourself or put your work into the world due to potential backlash, we strongly encourage you to apply. We recognize there are creatives out there who may have bypassed college to pursue other avenues, who didn't get into college because their passions didn't translate to collegiate testing, or who did not have access to the financial means to pay for college. This is why there are only 3 requirements for eligibility. Black creative, under the age of 21, and you submit a project: graphic design, photography, writing, audio, video, journalism, creative writing, to scholarship at armchairallamericans.com. That's scholarship at armchairallamericans.com.
Sure. So Oscar Tshiebwe is a 6'9 center who played at West Virginia this year. He was pretty good. He is a crazy, like, basically a rebounding specialist. He is
a good one.
A very high motor player, an outlier mover. Like, this is a guy who was it the first game of the year, or not the first game of the year, but one of the early games was just like making Xavier Johnson, one of the, like, the better guard athletes in college basketball, look really bad just with his ridiculous side to side movement for a guy who's 6'9 and what, like 250 pounds.
Enormous.
Yeah, he's enormous. The thing that was most disappointing to me about, well, act two things were really disappointing about Oscar this year. He was really below the rim player this year. And I didn't think he was like a crazy leaper coming into the year. His freakish athleticism was more in the moving side to side and the moving in a straight line, just crazy ground coverage guy. But he was really below the rim this year. I don't have Bart up right now, but if one of you could check the dunk numbers,
27 dunks.
Yeah, so that's not good.
Not great.
Yeah, so really a below the rim player, and then pretty much a total black hole in offense. And that one I think was pretty predictable. He was a major processor in high school, really, really slow decision maker. And that translated big time to West Virginia, not just slow decisions, but simply never passing the ball. Nonetheless, as a rotation big man who can move really well and still has like legit center, I don't want to say size because he's a little small height wise, but length and strength.
Physically, you think he can hold up with some fives.
Yeah, he can hold up with fives and is a really, really, really good mover. So in that sense, still fairly interesting. I think, like, he wasn't a crazy stock guy this year, but was still a pretty good defensive player. He had some pretty impressive like off-ball team defense moments where he was just like shutting off multiple things on one possession, and the ground coverage is really good. But definitely disappointed, is very old. You know, it, like Ben had mentioned earlier, he's one of those guys who kind of was dominating or I guess I mentioned this, not Ben, but was dominating at a low level of high school competition. I think his UA stuff was kind of hard to find as well.
I think he played Adidas.
Oh, sorry, Adidas. PD, what was your take on Oscar coming into the year?
Yeah, I think that he's disappointing because if you view him through the lens of being older and being a draft Twitter person, where, you know, the straight line speed, the, some of these like really fun tools that he had, he kind of had to blow everything out of the water this year. That was sort of the pathway for him to get drafted. Otherwise, he gets less interesting every single year. Pre-college, I thought that there was a case for him to be better than Isaiah Stewart for sort of the same role.
Certainly. And I think,
And, you know, he of the I nuked James Wiseman in a couple practices that got people hyped. He, this isn't mentioned as much, but the third day or the after they came back, I think it was a, like an All-American thing, like Wiseman gave Shiwei the breaks. And that's sort of been the biggest difficulty for me with Shiwei is that he doesn't punish like the people who aren't built like him quite enough. He doesn't put skinny dudes all the way in the rim and doesn't make them get them all the way off the floor, which is certainly a possibility. Like we don't talk about skinny centers getting played off the floor just for not being in the weight room enough, I think. And I thought that that was going to be something that happened a lot this year was that, you know, you just put Shiboy in there and people under 200 pounds just aren't admitted to the club. And I didn't feel like that happened enough to offset his other difficulties.
Yeah, and I don't think, I mean, I don't think West Virginia is the best spot. It's like a crazy great spot for Oscar. I mean, defensively, you know, it helps. And you, like Max said, he was pretty good defensively, you know, being able to use that mobility as just a versatile defender, you know, with his crazy size. And yeah, I mean, not crazy stocks, but still like a five-ish block percentage, which again.
Ben, are you saying that you don't like the pairing with Derek Culver?
It's not my favorite.
I like the fit better next year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as do I. Again, glad to see that. But Culver, you know, Culver is not a good pairing with Oscar. They played a lot of minutes together, a lot of Oscar at like the four kind of, and that's really just not an optimal role for him in any capacity. Like with like more space to be used as a roller, even though like again, like I think he has more vertical ability than he showed this year. And again, just being such an outlier mover, being able to get up and down the floor. I mean, get up and down the floor in the half court really quickly and move around in space. Spacing will be important for him. I mean, as it is for every prospect, but I think important for Oscar. And then not really having a lot of high-level passes around him. I mean, we all love Deuce McBride, but Deuce McBride has his issues as a passer. And West Virginia really doesn't have any like high-level creators on that team. I mean, they never really do. That's just not their thing. And again, Oscar struggles for that as being a guy who, I mean, unlike some of the Giannis stuff he did in high school, is not going to be anyone who's really able to dribble or create. Even though, I mean, I think he probably can, like, dribble a little more than he showed because, I mean, beyond, like, the low-level competition in, like, the Adidas tape that I see, like, there were some, like, genuine handling flashes in the open floor and in the half court. Again, got to be careful with these flashes, but I think that's something he could potentially do if given the opportunity. But yeah, it's just like it hurts me to be skeptical about Oscar going forward because I love him so much and like he's such a fun prospect. I really do believe in his skill set, but I just the fit at West Virginia is not something that lended well this year. And it, like PD said, I think it's gonna be better next year without Culver. And you know, hopefully Deuce McBride can, you know, make improvements and Isaiah Cottrell is good coming in. So yeah, I mean, again, someone who I'm hopeful, pessimistically kind of about, but I'm hopeful that he, you know, he ends up improving next year. So.
Yeah, Cottrell is my second favorite Huntington prep guy last year. I mean, I've never been interested in Brakefield even a little bit, but I think that Cottrell and Oscar is interesting. Max, you want to get to the what we learned or what we can take away from this?
If you have something, I didn't have anything in mind actually. So if you have something in mind, go ahead with it.
Yeah, it's that how much I think a big thing for Oscar was like looking at his AAU translation and like the amount to which the non-synergy stats are like jacked up. Is something I really, really didn't take away enough. I don't think that I listened to like the people who do data mining for the big scouting services seriously enough. And then like in the year since really listening to like their concerns about how unclean the data is. Like his numbers are ones that I feel like if we went back to some of his most eye-popping things, maybe a touch lower, And, you know, not having those numbers clean also means that it's hard to get a really firm grasp on how watered down the bottom half of each sneaker circuit is. So some of those games, if you can get, you know, a ranking among the teams and then sort of grade it from there, I think that Oscar definitely murdered the bottom section more than I was willing to admit at the time.
Yeah, and for me, it's just, you know, that and, you know, a reinforcement of being careful with these prospects who are kind of black holes, because that's one of the just the most difficult, you know, aspects of a player's game to overcome. I mean, just like the list of, you know, all-time draft busts is littered with these low assist to turnover ratio, no feel guys. And obviously Oscar, I mean, is very good for different reasons, but just have to be really good to make up for like a total inability to move the ball or create for yourself, or move the ball, make decisions, create for others. That's really important to look at.
This has kind of turned into the I eat crow for all of my mistakes preseason episode. Yeah. But I don't know where you guys were at on Oscar, but I had him quite high.
I had him borderline top 10, if not in the top 10.
Okay, then actually, then you had him higher than I did then. But
yeah, I will eat all of the crow.
Yeah, I guess my thing with Oscar is like, what was the idea of him as a guy worth like a lottery pick? Like, because I just don't know, like offensively, he was always going to be at best like a good role man, I guess, or a guy who can handle in transition. Like that's really it offensively. So like, was the idea of him as a really, really dominant defensive player? Because, I mean, I thought he was a really good defensive player. Like, I thought that he was pretty smart, and I thought his physical tools were kind of ridiculous. But even then, like, he wasn't, like, a god-tier defensive prospect. So, I think that I definitely got just, like, I don't know. I would have to think more critically about what I was doing ranking him that highly. But I'm not sure what the idea of Oscar was that he would be that high end of a prospect. Yeah. As opposed to just like a late first type at best who could be, I guess, soaking up a lot of minutes as a starting center who, well, I mean, it's probably kind of similar to the idea of what Wiseman is now, that this is a guy who can play a lot of minutes, and even more so than Wiseman is a guy who could actually survive on the floor late in the game on account of his movement ability. But then you run into the issues with the offense there, and, you know, that's pretty damaging on that end. So I don't know.
My idea was one I did buy in a lot. I think I still am probably more optimistic than you on your honest defensive ability. You know, being a guy at that level of physical tools and that level of movement, I really bought into that value. And I probably didn't place enough concern on his age, and I probably put too much into some of the handling and passing flashes, not even talking about his high school games, because, you know, I mean, I put too much into some of the handling stuff he did in AAU. It was just a tough class to rank even then. I wasn't sure about Oscar. Again, wouldn't have him top 10. I think I probably, in a re-rank, would still have him like lottery or a little below lottery. I'd still believe in that defense, but yeah, I was too high on him. That was a mistake. So. And this really is the eating crow episode for a lot of us, and I think people are going to enjoy that.
So I guess, like, how do you guys feel about Oscar going forward now? You had expressed some pessimism, but like also hopeful. Petey, how do you feel about Oscar going forward now?
I mean, as an older big, he has to show Xavier Tillman's type things to be truly interesting now. Like the physical domination has to get even more heightened. The feel has to be heightened, and he's probably has to flash shooting to return to the level of hyped prospecthood that he was at, even by the most conservative of people in draft Twitter. I think that's reasonable. He's going to be in a much better context next year. But for older players, they have to have a much higher level of improvement, because the freshman is going to come in and be, you know, the shiny new toy.
I think that's fair. What I'll say in Oscar's favor is that I kind of view him as like a similar tier prospect to someone like Zeke Nnaji, where I think that he is a kind of niche big, but it's a valuable niche, in that he can be this guy who is like a really, really plus mover. Like, he can be your switch. Well, probably not your switch big, but he can be a mobile big for you while also having the physical ability to be an actual center. I think that's fairly appealing. So, like, I don't think that's someone who ever rises to the level of hype that he had achieved on draft Twitter. But I do think that that can be a pretty solid prospect, like a solid second round prospect. And that's kind of where I'm at on Oscar going forward, is like a solid second round guy, but certainly not hyping him up in the lottery range anymore.
All right, so I think we should cut it for this part. Yeah.
Yeah, let's cut it, and then we'll see. We have had so many.
You guys don't know. Yeah, I mean, the listeners won't know that we've had a lot of technical difficulties. They never know, but right now you're going to know. It's been all this afternoon.
This has been the most disastrous episode ever.
Thank God for Squadcast, the program we use to record
this. Yeah, and content is good in spite of it, I mean, bonus points for us. But if not, great on a curve. It's not our fault.
It's not my fault. I had none of the technical difficulties.
Okay, yeah, my fault that the East Coast has been hit by a monsoon and I have very unreliable Wi-Fi and power.
I mean, it's kind of your fault you have a bad computer. I mean, that's not really... So let's outro this thing. Thank you all so much for listening to this part. You can follow PD on Twitter at Above the Break 3. We all love his work. Recently did a Desmond Bane thing. You should go read it. Follow the pod at Prep Number 2 Pro Pod. We are very close to 100 reviews on Apple Podcasts. What are we, like 93, 94?
We're up to like 97, I think.
Oh, wow. So yeah, let's get us to 100. That would be sick. Those help a lot. You can follow me on Twitter at Ben_Pfeiffer_. Follow Max at Max A. Carlin. And that's going to be it for part one. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you later.